history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, the stories are there, and taking the time to search them out always proves worthwhile for those of us with the privilege of listening to the stories, and also for those who summon the courage to share them. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks the 78th anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, so you probably guessed that would be the focus of this episode. Dozens of Pearl Harbor survivors have shared their memories here on Hometown Heroes over the years, representing many different ships and many different military installations around Oahu. Sadly, most of the Pearl Harbor survivors we've met on this program are no longer with us, but I want to focus today on four of them who are, and who all have some 2019 updates to their stories, even some this weekend updates. So much of the attention every December 7th ends up on the battleship USS Arizona, which suffered the greatest loss of life 78 years ago and still rests in the harbor as one of the most moving memorials you'll ever have the chance to visit. Last year marked the first time that not a single USS Arizona survivor was able to attend the commemoration ceremonies at Pearl Harbor. This year, there are only three members of the Arizona's crew still alive, and one of them will be at Pearl this year for a very special reason. 98-year-old Lou Conter received a hero's welcome when he landed in Honolulu this week, complete with a water arch and a red carpet. On this 78th anniversary, Lou is participating in the interment of his shipmate, Lauren Bruner, who passed away in September. Bruner, like many other Arizona survivors, chose to have his remains added to those shipmates who've been entombed on the ship since 1941. Lou Conter will be there in person, and the other two remaining survivors from the Arizona, Ken Potts of Utah and Don Stratton of Colorado, will of course be there in spirit. One of the items I have linked for you this week at hometownheroesradio.com is a video about the connection between Stratton and a 7-year-old boy in North Carolina who became fascinated with the story of Pearl Harbor. I hope you'll check that out, as well as Don Stratton's book. At age 97, Don is still going strong in Colorado Springs. He is the last survivor among a group of six men who escaped the burning ship thanks to Joe George, a sailor who disobeyed an order and tossed a line from the nearby USS Vestal to the spot where Don and his fellow sailors were trapped.
My battle station was a sight setter in the port and aircraft guns on the port side, and that was up about 55, 60 feet in the air on the tripod mast on the foremast.
And people hear you say that, and maybe some of them have already read your book, All the Gallant Men, or they've seen one of your interviews or heard you before, but when people imagine that morning and they think about you being in that position, that many feet in the air with these Japanese planes coming in and bombs dropping, I'm sure they say, how in the world did you survive? You ever wonder that yourself?
Well, it had to be a lot of to do with the good Lord, I guess, and but we were kind of trapped up there. We got out of the director and on the deck there, and the vessel was alongside a repair ship, and we got a hold of a seaman there that threw us a heaving line with that's a line with a lead on the end to stretch it out, and they small line, and then he added a big, heavier line, and we pulled that across, and we tied it off on the Arizona, and we started hand over hand across it, and we were already burnt. I was burned like over 60% of my body, I guess, at that time.
How did that occur? You were in that position on the foremast when the big explosion happened?
The bomb that hit on the starboard side behind number two turret went into a million pounds of ammunition, and it blew up. It just was a fireball that just engulfed us up there where we were at, and no way to escape or get off. So until we got the line there to go hand over hand across, we're kind of just stymied up there, and we finally got off. Six of us went across there.
But I'm just trying to imagine what those moments were like when you're engulfed in flames and your flesh is burning and you're trapped and you can't go anywhere. What do you do?
you're just trying to get out away from the flames and thinking about how the hell am I going to get out of here.
So if that seaman hadn't had that idea to tie that line.
Well, we kind of indicated that we wanted to get off of there, and he throwed us a heaving line, which is a small line, and then tied on the heavier line, and it was about probably 65, 70 feet across there, and we had to go hand over hand across there.
So already you said 60%+ of your body had been burned. So is that upper body, lower body?
Well, the whole body, everything.
But your hands were okay?
My hands were burnt. I don't even have any fingerprints.
Well, was that from the explosion or was that from going down that line?
That was both.
So your hands are burnt, and then you have to hold on to a line or else you're going to fall to your death.
Right.
With hands that are already burnt, and I can't imagine what that feels like, the pain that you must have been experiencing. Or did adrenaline take over?
Well, it's just self-preservation.
So you get down to that other ship, the Vestal, which is next to the Arizona. I've interviewed a couple guys who were on that ship, and they've described what your ship looked like. But once you got aboard on the Vestal, there's still a lot going on, probably. What did you see from there?
Well, we stood around there for quite a while. The Vestal was busy with firing their guns and whatever and trying to get away from the side of the Arizona and the explosion. And they finally got us in the shore boat and took us to the beach, and they picked us up in an open-air truck and took us to the hospital.
And how long were you in the hospital?
A year.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Wasn't quite that long. It was like till the next September.
And I'm sure, well, I've read some of your story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand how you experienced it. So very few people alive experienced what you experienced. You're in all this pain, and you know you're going to recover. But was it a daily basis in those days that followed that you were learning of other guys that you knew from the ship who didn't make it?
Well, we most certainly figured that, but there was a few ex-sailors in the hospital with us and everything, so but we knew we'd suffered a devastating hit and a lot of casualties, but it took a lot of baths, saltwater baths, and a lot of healing and a lot of patience.
Yeah, where did that come from? You're a pretty young guy. You haven't been through a whole lot until this.
Well, you do what you have to do.
Did your parents know you were alive, or did that take a while?
No, they got a notice that I didn't make it, and then they got a notice that I did. But they sent us back to Mare Island Hospital and went through a lot of baths, a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm. Kept the burns open to the healing air. I wanted to go back into the Navy, so I went back after I was home for about a year, and my whole left side healed up really much from the medical discharge. So I re-enlisted and went back in, and they put me on I went to boot camp again because it hadn't caught up on my shots and stuff, and I went to island there in the bay, and they put me aboard a destroyer, DD-406 USS Stack. We headed for the South Pacific right away, and we were in on the invasion of the whole land in New Guinea and a couple of islands offshore there, and we went to Guadalcanal and picked up troops to put in the Philippines and the Lady, and we were in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and we were in the Battle of Luzon Gulf, and we led all the invasions in with the mine sweeps, and finally Okinawa, and we were on pick of a patrol 300 miles north of Okinawa between there and Japan, and for the kamikazes coming down, and let them know down below that they were on their way, and that was kind of hazardous. We lost 5 ships one night there, and they sent me back to the States, and the war was over, and I had a game.
And I understand that you lived that, and that you've told your story many times. So that is, in a way, old hat to you. But you do understand how crazy that sounds to most people, right? That you were burned over the majority of your body. You still don't have any feeling in your fingers that you haven't had for 75 years. You're recovering for a year in the hospital. You've been medically discharged. But you sign up to go back, and you end up fighting the rest of the war. Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that happens, I guess. Felt like maybe I should be there, but whatever happened, but that's the way it worked.
And the title of your book is All the Gallant Men, and you're honoring those who died December 7th and really the 406,000 Americans who died in the war. But it strikes me that just that action you took, I mean, you are the gallant man. Did you feel that you were doing something beyond what was asked of you?
No, the heroes were still out there.
Still on your ship.
Yep.
What'd your parents think when you re-enlisted?
Well, actually, they didn't want me to go, but they said if that's what you're made up your mind to do, it's your life to live. It's just the thing that surprise attacked and didn't get a chance to fight back too much, so I was still in the same predicament. I loved the Navy, and so I went back in. Like I tell everybody, everybody had to be someplace, and I was there.
And one of only three still with us who were there on the USS Arizona on December 7th, 1941. Don't forget to go to hometownheroesradio.com for the video of Don Stratton with his new friend, 7-year-old Landon Nestrick, to whom Don entrusted a piece of the ship he had long kept in his home. That relic is now on display at Landon School in Charlotte, North Carolina. There's another video I have linked for you online that I don't think you'd ever see coming. Wally Walling has been back to Pearl Harbor many times, but this year he's marking the 78th anniversary in Lodi, California. I'm going to tell you why in a moment, but first let's hear a little of what Mr. Walling remembers about that fateful morning from his unique vantage point of an observation tower that still stands at Pearl Harbor.
It's a beautiful day, and all at once, overhead, we've got planes, high planes, low planes, all coming in on us. Oh, must be a big maneuver today. Those orange balls up there is not ringing the bell yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ringing the bell even when we see those black objects dropping out of those planes.
It hasn't hit you yet that this is enemy.
That isn't it. Mm-hmm. And when the bomb went off on Fort Allen, and all the planes are exploding everywhere, we know we're in war.
And you saw that, clear as day.
I watched it all. I'm the only one that can tell you the Pearl Harbor story, and this is the reason why. I'm looking down on everything. You're on a ship. Mm-hmm. And that ship gets hit by a torpedo or what? Who sees that? The ship itself. That's all. They can't see beyond it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking down on everything. But remember this, you can't see it all at one time because everything's blowing up at one time.
Right.
So you can't even follow it.
Mm-hmm.
All you can just pick up in pieces. See?
Well, and that's what, you know, on this program over the years, I've heard from guys who are on a lot of different ships or on land while this is happening, and they have those little slivers of the puzzle that they saw from their perspective. And your perspective is intriguing, and what you're saying is you're the last guy left that was in that tower and looking from that spot where you could see each one of these things that's happening. You're, what, 19, 20 years old?
19.
What in the world was going through your head?
I'm froze to the rail because the first thing that happened just before the plane started dropping. It was Hickam Field is blowing up. It's right behind me. I'm looking, maybe a couple minutes or something before the raid started right over Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
So Hickam Field is destroyed immediately. Now I'm froze to that rail because I have joined the greatest Navy of all times. And here it is, being blown up in my face in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm devastated. Because if they can do that in 10 minutes, what else is coming?
Right.
And scuttlebutt is everywhere. They've already landed on the other side, and, oh, man, you don't know what to believe.
I'm sure there's all kinds of stuff, and I want to hear about that, but I hope I didn't cut you off in describing what you saw there in the order you saw it. So you saw those explosions on Fort Island.
See, the Arizona never blew up till 8:06. It's the last ship that blew up because your California sunk, Oklahoma's rolled over, the Utah's rolled over,
mm-hmm.
and the West Virginia's got hit by at least 7 torpedoes. It's a mess. It went straight down.
And you're seeing each one of these?
I'm seeing it after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot possibly see it because you're looking there, a bomb went off, one's already gone there. You're looking and seeing after the fact. We can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way of us doing a thing.
You can imagine how helpless a feeling that would be. For decades now, Wally Walling has shared his story, trying to educate others about Pearl Harbor and the importance of keeping America alert. He published his memoirs last year. I have those linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, in addition to his complete original interview. But now he is marking the 78th anniversary at a special lighting ceremony in Lodi, California, where the owners of All Save Energy, the Hamilton family, have made Wally the centerpiece of their annual Christmas light display. They took measurements to produce an accurate likeness, and with more than 10,000 lights, 5,000 zip ties, and 6,000 feet of rebar, they have constructed a 60-foot-tall Christmas light statue of this Pearl Harbor survivor. Wally has always had a larger-than-life presence, but this Pearl Harbor Day and this holiday season, that presence is larger than ever. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come, including the story of one survivor who is back on Oahu this weekend, 78 years after he says a childhood lesson saved his life. Find out what he means by that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Pearl Harbor-themed episode as we mark the 78th anniversary of that date which has lived in infamy. We continue now with the memories of George Coburn, who was on the battleship USS Oklahoma on December 7th, 1941.
That morning, while I was in the plotting room, I heard the public address system was keyed open, and I could hear a hiss and a little background noise, and then this voice came up and said, "All hands, man your battle stations." And then he came back and said, "Real planes, real bombs, no shit." And it was an officer who said that. And later he explained that he knew that enlisted men used no shit as an exclamation and to emphasize a point, and he wanted to emphasize the real planes, real bombs. But it worked backward, because I heard that, and I thought, geez, that doesn't belong on a public address system. This must be a bogus announcement total. And I went over to the next compartment. There was an electrician there, and I asked him what he thought about it, and he says, some drunk probably got back from Liberty and found access to the PA system, decided he'd have a little fun. A more authoritative voice came up on the PA system and made the standard call to battle stations, and also set off the general alarm. And so I started for my battle station. I made a detour to go to the shop and get my shirt out of my locker. because you didn't go topside without a shirt in those days. My battle station was in an anti-aircraft director, and so I had a lot of climbing to do to get up there. And the Navy had a rule for everything, and traffic control was you move forward and up on the starboard side and aft and down on the port side. But they had another rule, and that was in the event of an air raid, all unengaged personnel go below the second deck, which was an armored deck. So I got to the up ladder, and they were sending people down, and I couldn't get up. I never got to my battle station. When the last man cleared the hatch, they slammed it down and dogged it down tight from up above. So there were probably, about 20 men in this little area where the ladder, they were all people who had topside battle stations, and of course nobody got there. The first torpedo hit, and the deck jumped, and it was a little bit more of a shock than when the main battery went off. But we weren't unaccustomed to explosions because we had gunnery practice fairly often. And anyway, the lights went out, more torpedoes hit the ship. I've heard all kinds of numbers on how many there were, and I didn't try to count them, so I can't argue with them.
Is that the first time that it was really real to you, though, when you felt the impact of that first torpedo? Is that when you first knew that this was real and this was war?
Yeah, I would guess that was probably the beginning of realization that we got a problem here. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened was a source of oil got ruptured, and we got sprayed with fuel oil, and the deck got covered with fuel oil. And because of that, and the ship was beginning to list, people couldn't stand up. And it wound up that a pool of oil formed against the low side bulkhead, and men were slipping into that pool and just wallowing around in oil down there. I've thought many times, if they just thought about it, they'd have figured out how to get the heck out of there, but they didn't. As far as I know, they probably perished right there.
Because they drowned in the pool of oil?
Well, because they couldn't get out of the ship because they were stuck in this pool. And
again, this is in the dark as well. The lights are out. Can you see anything?
I could see a little because somebody showed up with a flashlight, and that was a big help. It helped the guys that were up on the ladder and trying to get the hatch open. It helped them a lot because they were using their fists and or anything they could find to try to hammer the dogs from their tight position. And well, they finally got it open, and everybody rushed for the ladder, and the darn thing broke. I don't know just what happened, but either some fitting came loose or the pin that secured the top of the ladder sheared, because had a lot of men on the ladder, and the deck was over maybe 45 degrees by then, and oil on the deck didn't help the ladder stay in position either, so it just twisted. And somebody had the good sense to yell, "Everybody get the hell off the ladder or nobody will get out of here. It'll break." And so the people complied with that, and then we went up one by one, and I don't know whether everybody got out or not, but we got up to the second deck and then on up to the main deck, and there was probably 10 of us together at that time, and I looked back, the normal exit from the ship would be out onto the quarter deck, and that was about maybe 100 feet away. There was a big group of men back there. It didn't appear to be moving. And besides, there was all kinds of gear and lockers and bunks and everything that was loose or jarred loose by the explosions had slid down against the bulkhead, and we would have had to crawl or make our way over that stuff in order to get back to the weather deck. I saw an open porthole. Shouldn't have been open. We were at general quarters. If it had been closed, I probably wouldn't even thought of trying to get out a porthole. But I decided that's for me. I went, crawled up across whatever was available to get a handhold on, and a few fellows followed me. Some of them went and started going back to the weather deck. And anyway, six of us got out of that porthole. And at the time, the side of the ship was easy to stand on because ship had rolled over far enough to where it wasn't level yet, but it was close to it. And some of the things I should have mentioned. When we were down in the fourth deck and torpedoes were hitting, and we had the light from a flashlight, but no more. Some of the guys were yelling, and some were cursing, and some were praying. And I'll always remember one voice that called for Mama to come and help. He called repeatedly, "Mama, come and help me." And he was in the pool of oil. And,
well, what about you? I mean, you're describing this. I know you're a 22-year-old young man at the time. You didn't know this was going to happen. This came completely out of the blue. I mean, it sounds absolutely terrifying. Did you feel that fear? Was there panic? How did you handle it?
I didn't feel any fear or panic, but I think I was in shock. It isn't hard to remember, because I'll remember this the most hours forever. I don't know.
And I know there are a lot of other details here, but if you hadn't seen that open porthole, what do you think would have happened to you?
I probably would have died in the ship. Linda has told me repeatedly, says, "You're both lucky and smart." She said, you made a lot of good decisions to get out of the ship, and you also were lucky to have the avenues available to get out.
Pearl Harbor survivor George Coburn was referring to his friend Linda Dudick there. She's done remarkable work in preserving the stories of World War II veterans in the North County area of San Diego. She's the one who introduced us to George, and shortly after he shared his story here in April of this year, Linda's efforts led to George finally receiving the medals he had never gotten during World War II, including the Purple Heart. You can link to an article about that at hometownheroesradio.com. And the final Pearl Harbor survivor we hear from today is 98-year-old Stu Headley, who is back at Pearl Harbor this week thanks to the Best Defense Foundation, the nonprofit headed by former NFL linebacker Donnie Edwards that took five survivors back to Oahu this week. Stu Headley was a 20-year-old aboard the battleship West Virginia on December 7th, 1941.
When I reached for my hat, I got kicked right in the seat of the pants by a first-class bosun mate, Hicks. "Get to your battle station on the double. This is the real thing." I grabbed my hat and ran on top sight. Planes are diving from every direction. And similar to this, a gun sets up off the deck. Mm-hmm. And it's all open underneath. I saw this pilot, Lieutenant White, shooting with his .45. Well, I dove under there with him. Now, I'm a seaman first class. He's a lieutenant commander, so I'm not going to question. But I'm thinking. And he says, "Son, where's your battle station?" and I pointed up the gun three. He says, get up there as fast as you can. As I was going up the ladder to get in the turret, here come a Japanese torpedo plane down the port side. I could see the pilot, the radioman, and the co-pilot laughing like everything. I got inside the turret, and Crozen was already in the trainer's seat. Nobody was up on the gun deck, no shellmen or rammers or anybody. So I went down to my battle station. When I go out to the schools, I put on a little demonstration. I point out how the Lord protected me. When I was 9 years old, I used to like to sit in the chair and lean back on the back two legs. My dad only spoke twice. Third time he acted. And you, yes, sir, and no, sir, in our house.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the kitchen, and I'm leaning back on the back two legs. My dad walked in. Stuart, they made four legs and a chair to sit on the floor. Yes, sir. But how quick a 9-year-old forgets. So next time I'm leaning back, my dad says, Stuart, I'll not tell you again. Yes, sir. In this ear and out that ear. So the next time I'm leaning back, my dad walked in the kitchen, kicked the bag leg out from underneath me. I cracked my head on the floor. I said, there's got to be a better way. Now you see my legs back up under. That's 9 years old, a habit that I learned. I'm now 20 years old, and I'm in my battle station. Normally, my feet would be on a platform. I would be bent over, cranking in the dials for the elevation that they want that gun raised.
And this is a big 16-inch gun.
16-inch cannon.
How big are the projectiles in that?
It stands 5'2". It's 16 inches in diameter. They weigh 2,700 pounds. I called it a Volkswagen going out the barrel. And it takes 5 100-pound bags of black powder to hurl that shell from San Diego to Oceanside.
Uh-huh.
That is, if I've got that gun elevated to maximum height, that shell will fly 30 miles.
I just wanted people to have a sense of this isn't a little anti-aircraft gun. This the biggest you got.
So now I'm in my battle position, but we're not going to fire these 16-inch guns in Pearl. We'll blow Pearl Harbor off the map.
Yeah.
And so consequently, my feet were back up underneath me. I'm on a high stool. No back. J.A. phones on. And we could hear the machine gun bullets hitting the turret. We felt the thud of a torpedo. And Crozen says, Stu, let's see what's going on. We took the sight cap off our periscope and bam, there went the Arizona. And I estimated there were about 32 bodies that flew through the atmosphere.
So I want people to understand what you're saying here. Because very few people actually saw the Arizona
explode.
They saw the aftermath. They saw the smoke, or they heard it and they turned.
We saw it.
When you looked into this viewfinder right before the bomb hit.
And see, I immediately thought that a bomb went down this stack because it looked like the ship broke in half. When I met this fellow here, I found out the truth. Jack McCarran was one that was blown off the ship into the burning oil. But he later informed me that he had been informed that an armor-piercing shell went through the starboard side of the forecastle right into number one handling room. There's 1,000 bags of black powder in each one of the handling rooms. That exploded. That set off turret two. That's what broke the ship in half.
But you're a 20-year-old kid.
I'm a 20-year-old brat growing up overnight.
And you're looking at a ship just like yours, another battleship.
Yep.
Blowing up and bodies flying through the air.
Yep.
How do you react to that?
Startled, surprised, but waiting for the next scenario.
And we'll hear about that next scenario when this special Pearl Harbor edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing now with 98-year-old Stu Headley, who is back at Pearl Harbor this weekend for the 78th anniversary of that world-changing day. When we left off, he had described witnessing the explosion that split the USS Arizona apart, but soon his battleship, the USS West Virginia, would be hit as well.
The next scenario was an armor-piercing shell dropped from a high-level bomber came through our turret, and what he'd done, he took 15-inch armor-piercing shells. Mm-hmm. They welded fins on them so that they would spiral. Well, over top of our left gun is a catapult, and I called it a slingshot. And we had two airplanes on that catapult that morning. One was a scout observation plane, an SOU-2, and the other was the Kingfish, the Admiral's plane. Well, the scout observation is a biplane. The top wing is the gas tank. The Admiral's plane is a single wing. And when that shell hit, it hit the top wing of the scout plane. The gasoline exploded, burnt the plane to a crisp, split that catapult in half, and came down through 5 inches of steel right into the left gun. And the reason I'm here today is because that shell did not explode. And here's a picture of it taken on December the 9th. That's the inside of the turret.
And I'll put this picture up at hometownheroesradio.com. And I think some people who've been paying close attention are doing the math or following your drift on this. But go ahead and connect the dots for me from don't sit on two legs of a chair to the reason you're still here.
When the Arizona blew up, we didn't know it at the time. 1,177 men died instantly aboard that ship. You ever been out to Pearl?
Sure.
You've been aboard the memorial?
Yes.
You've seen the onyx wall, the plaque, with 1,177 names. But since then, there's been about, I would say, pretty close to 50 to 100 bodies put inside the ship.
Right.
So right after that explosion, I had my feet back up under. Right by my feet is a hatch, just big enough for a person to crawl through from one side to the other. It's locked down with four steel dogs. It blew that hatch right off those four steel dogs, that explosion. My footrest was just torn right off. If my feet had been out where they would be, I would have no legs, and I probably wouldn't be alive.
You wouldn't have made it off the ship.
No. Nobody would have known we were there because there was only the two of us in that right gun. And went right past my legs, underneath the elevating screw, past Crozen's legs, and landed against the barbette, picking both of us up simultaneously and throwing us 8 feet back into the elevating screw. Now, I had the JA phones on, and when I picked myself up off the deck, Crozen says, "Stu, let's get out of here." So I said, "A good idea," only he didn't say it quite that nice. And in order to get out, you got to go up a ladder to the primer deck. And when I got to the primer deck, I reached the end of the cord. And I grabbed a hold of the belt, snapped it in half, and threw the whole thing down to the pit. I spent 20 years trying to stretch one of those belts. Couldn't do it. And it wasn't until after I retired that I understood how it was possible. And I show the kids the Inquirer magazine that I had. and it says a mother lifted a one-ton car up off her son. And I said, that's an impossibility. But I read the article, then I understood. The adrenaline flows right through your body when you're in a state of excitement. So anyhow, we got on a topside. Our ship was on about a 15-degree list. Mm-hmm. And you can see the Tennessee is on one inboard of us. Now, a shell that hit the number 2 turret on the Tennessee killed my captain. Captain Bennion came out of his battle station, walked around the flying bridge over to the starboard side when a shell hit the edge of number 2 turret, and a piece of that shrapnel flew up and went through the lookout tower and tore my vice president's leg wide open. He got the Purple Heart. I never earned a Purple Heart for the whole war and the Korean War. And I told Crozen when we got out of topside, I says, if I don't get killed today, I'll live to see the end of this war. How can you say that, Stu? I said, if you've got the faith to believe it, you can do it. He says, I don't have that kind of faith. June 12th, 1942, he was on board the Honolulu. They took a torpedo through the bow of the ship. He was asleep in his bunk, and the steel crushed him to death.
And we're still in the early stages of this attack on the morning of Sunday, December 7th, 1941. You're up topside, but the reason you're saying, if I survive today, is that's not a certainty. There's still a lot going on. What happened next?
Well, while Crozen and I were watching the Oklahoma capsize, 12 minutes, Ensign Sears, a junior officer of our division, was screaming for us to get over on the Tennessee. And what he wanted us to do was to straddle the line and jimmy across. Well, while we were watching the Oklahoma go over, a plane zoomed in between the two ships and machine gunned all 5 of our buddies, and they just toppled in between the ship.
So they're on the line between the two ships.
Yeah.
And they get picked off like sitting ducks by these Japanese machine gun bullets.
Yep.
And I could see, as you described that, that the emotions are still stirred when you recall that.
Oh, yes. And I told Crozen, we're not going over any lines. How are we going to get over, Stu? I says, I don't know yet, but we'll find a way. As I was watching the Oklahoma capsize, we had 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft guns that stuck out over the side of the ship. Mm-hmm. So I said, Crozen, did you ever run down a railroad track? He said, what are you talking about? I says, did you ever walk on a well, when I was a kid, I said, you're going to do it today. What do you mean? I said, you see that gun barrel? We're going to go over in the Marine casemate starboard side, climb up on that gun barrel, run across it, and jump down in the Tennessee. The gun barrel is about that big around.
Yeah, for couple that feet
five,
wide.
Five-inch. And so he says, you go first. I says, okay. So I usually ask the kids, where do you think I was going when I hit the deck of the Tennessee? They don't have it. I says, I was going right back up into turret 3. That's my battle station. You talk about Pavlov's law. And I was on the third rung when a Marine lifted me off with his foot. Crozen was still coming down the deck. And he said, haven't you had enough of those turrets? What do you want us to do? Get over on the beach. I says, how? Swim, you idiot. And the fire, as you saw in that picture just a minute ago, this is the oil that's blazing on the water from the ships. Crozen and I went over on the starboard side of the Tennessee. Here's all these nice, neatly piled clothes and shiny shoes. So I said, Crozen, we're going to strip down to our shorts, undershorts, and we're going to jump in. We're not going to dive. I says, we don't want to hit our head on anything. And I said, go just as deep as you can and swim underwater. Well, I qualified as an ABC swimmer in boot camp, not an underwater swimmer. But I'll guarantee I swam underwater that morning, or I wouldn't be here.
How far did you have to go?
I would say about twice the distance we are to that wall. Not too far, but with that burning oil, and like I say, I wasn't an underwater swimmer. I came up twice, and I thrashed like mad to get that oil and fire away. Hottest breath I ever breathed in my life. It's a wonder it didn't scorch my lungs. Twice we broke surface. The next time we were at the beach, and they took us right over to the dispensary and walked right across the deck, and it's a great big red cross. It's an open patio style with a deck all the way around with a railing, and we went up there. They examined us for any burns or any lacerations, any wounds of any kind, and they had tables and chairs and cots, a bed that they moved out, anything that they could put a body on. I was asked to speak out at UCSD, and this gal said, "Stuart, when you get to the point where you were at the dispensary, I want you to tell, you're going to be speaking to 85 doctors, surgeons, their admirals and generals, and I want you to tell them what your supplies were that morning." I says, "Kathy, you mean that?" I said, "They've got the finest of equipment and everything." "Yes." I said, "All right." So when I got to this point, they gave us a tube of unguentine ointment put on the burns. They gave us a jar of sulfa drug. That's to pour into the wounds and lacerations. Then they gave us morphine, cans of morphine, to minister to those that were dying or in dire pain. With those three items, we saved lives. Well, we were taking care of these fellows, and it's now about 9:25, and the second wave is coming in. And while we were taking care of these fellows, I looked up, and I saw two planes approaching Fort Island. And I yelled, "Duck!" And we went under the benches, the tables, whatever we could. And glass just shattered all over the place. And one of the planes, when it lifted up, dropped a bomb right in the center of that patio. Now, 59 years later, on a Tiger cruise, the year 2000, we went over to Hawaii. And I told the fellas, "I want to go to that dispensary that I was in." So I walked right across the decking, walked up the stairs, and they're all dental offices across there now. I walked in, and these are corpsmen that are working with dentistry. And I said, 59 years ago, I was in this building. Those kids, what are you talking about? They didn't understand. They didn't know anything about the history of it. And I said, "Yes, 59 years ago, I was in this very building." Well, one of the dentists, who was a lieutenant commander, heard me. And he came over, and he said, "Did I hear you right? You were in this building 59 years ago? That would have been December 7, 1941. I said, "Yes, sir." "Come here, I'll show you something." I had walked right across that decking, and I took a picture. These are the three fellows that were with me. And we stopped the car, and we took photographs of the bullet holes down the landing field.
That are still there.
Yep.
Yep.
And this is a picture where I walked across the decking, but when he took me back down, I took a picture of what he showed me. That's where the bomb hit.
They have one tile in the floor there now that says, has a bomb, and it says December 7th, 1941.
Yep.
But on that date, I mean, this is a tile that's there now memorializing that.
Great big red cross was painted across that deck so that from the air, you would know that it was a dispensary or a hospital.
But that's exactly where they hit.
That's where they hit.
It was X marks the spot.
You better believe it.
What was the impact? What was the result of that bomb?
Well, dust flew all over everywhere, and I would say it was about 5 to 7, 8 minutes later that the dust cleared away. We looked over the banister. We didn't see a speck of red anywhere. Just literally tore that whole thing and turned it upside down.
The cross was gone.
Gone.
What about the patients that you guys have been treating?
they were still on the beds, but glass was all over them and everything.
You know, you've described all this, and I know you've told your story hundreds of times, if not thousands of times. And I can't imagine how many lives have been impacted by your willingness to tell this story. But I'm struck by how much detail you remember. And the one thing I'm trying to figure out is how? How did you do all this? How did you manage to keep on going? And how terrified were you with this situation that nothing could have prepared you for?
Yes, there was a preparation. Because, see, we were out there a whole year before the attack. And we had battle drills. We had gun drills. We had man overboard drills. We had all kinds of drills that we were continuously practicing. So when the real thing happened, we're prepared and we do just what we're trained to do.
But
and
Stu,
you don't stop. And
but Stu, you saw bodies flying through the air. Then your body was blown back 8 feet. And you're holding your breath underwater because there's fire on the top. And you get to the beach. And when you get there, there's all these guys who are injured and maimed and dying. And you're treating them only to get bombed again where you're treating them. I mean, how can anything prepare you for that? And what
the
was
Lord.
It that, yeah, that was it.
The Lord prepared me for everything. He assured me, I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will be with you whatever you go through. That was where my faith was and my trust. That was all during the war. I get up in the morning and I thank him for the night's rest. And I ask him to give me the wisdom, guide and direct me to the people that he wants me to talk to, and give me the message that he wants me to share.
And he is still doing that at age 98. The central message he's sharing this weekend in Honolulu, remember Pearl Harbor, keep America alert. What a privilege today to share the memories of four amazing men with you. 78 years ago this weekend, they were four young men from four different states, Nebraska, Michigan, California, and New York, who had no idea how a Sunday morning in paradise would turn into a day that changed the world. There's a lot more to explore at hometownheroesradio.com if you have the time and the interest. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more of something our few remaining Pearl Harbor survivors have known for oh so long. Freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with Honor.